How Did I Get Here is the name of my podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Gowdy. Welcome to episode 4, part 1. Episode 4 comes in two parts. I interviewed a gentleman named Donnie Wynn, who is a legendary drummer. He's played with Brooks and Dunn. He's played with a lot of people I know around Texas. He's played with Dr. John, and mostly he played with Robert Palmer through all the records, you know, that he made from the Doctor Give Me the News to the Heavy Nova. Donnie Wynn was playing with them. So this conversation was a long conversation. Donnie came over to my apartment. We sat down and we just started talking. And I've tried to edit it because I thought it was, I just thought by length it was too long. But upon listening to it a couple of times, I actually really enjoyed listening to it and I enjoyed listening to the conversation. It's kind of the point of this podcast. So I'm going to leave it intact, split it into two parts and give you the whole hour and 35 minutes that we talked. Hopefully you'll like it. You'll learn something about Donnie Wynn. Donnie's a good friend of mine. He's played on a couple of albums that I've produced. He's played with me, a lot of shows with me, and we've spent a lot of time together. About 6 years ago, he and another friend of mine, Bobby Thomas, formed a label called F&M Records, and they released my album, Boy in a Box. And they released a record that I made on my own in my house when I was going through my divorce. And they let me do what I want. They released a record that I basically played everything on, recorded, and mixed at my house. With the exception of a couple of songs. So Donnie's a very supportive person when it comes to art. He's very art-oriented. He's totally given himself to playing, and he enjoys himself a lot making music. I think you'll get that from him in this conversation. So episode 4 is a two-parter. Part 1 is about 35 minutes, and then I found a good little breaking point to switch to part 2, which is about an hour. So thanks for listening so far. I've gotten a lot of good feedback. All the iTunes stuff is up. Everything's going. So you have that going on. And I guess just sit back and enjoy my conversation with Donnie Wynn.
Couple of memories.
Does it?
Yeah, man, that was a real special time. It was probably the most important record I ever made was that one, of which that came from Clues, right. The album Clues.
What a song, Looking for Clues.
I've already dated myself, right?
You have.
I called it an album.
Yeah. It was
an
LP.
That's what it was in those days. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a strange one. That was only the second record I had done with the gentleman in question, Robert Palmer, and we were on tour promoting the record before that, Secrets. We had Bad Case of Loving You, all that stuff. Can We Still Be Friends, some other ones. But we were on tour, and I'll never forget, we were in Salem, Massachusetts, and there was this wonderful woman from Buffalo, New York, who was with me at the time. And
it's like in the movie Almost Famous. Like you picked her up in another city and she came with you?
We called it importing.
Yeah. Okay.
You imported, you know? Because we always allowed girlfriends and paramours and whatnot to join in, you know?
Yeah.
And it was always an understood thing. So, yeah, there was this wonderful young lady. We were enjoying each other's company, and this insistent knock at the door. I tried to ignore it, and finally started, you know, saying, go away, you know. And then a voice coming back started saying, hey, I got to play you something. And I recognize whose voice it is. And understand, my room used to be the gathering room when we were on the road. I had this thing that Keith Richards had. It was this Nakamichi Little David system that fit into a Halliburton suitcase.
Okay.
You can have the thing set up in 30 seconds, and you're blowing the walls out of the place. I mean, it was awesome.
That's awesome.
So my room was the guy. I had one. I went and bought one. Keith told me about it. Told me this one place in New York City that made it. I went and got it. These old Jewish guys. I got it. $1,000. It was a good deal.
Yeah.
And Robert was banging. Finally, I'm like, what? You know, I got this chick in here. And he goes, man, I heard a song. We got to listen to it. It's important, I think. I was like, but he goes, it's important. And I'm like, I got to listen to motherfucker here. He seems to kind of have his finger on the bead. So I think I'll let him in. I was like, Patty, you know, Robert's coming in for a second. He played me Gary Numan's Cars.
Right.
Over and over. And I mean, we started listening to it at about 1 o'clock. It was a good 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning.
Still listening to it.
Before finally, yeah. I mean, over, just repeat, over and over. There was something that just really got him about the time structure, the way time was really on it.
Yeah.
Because before that, things, you know, there weren't click tracks. Yeah. There weren't drum machines. Right. Well, there were click tracks, but. Right.
They were primitive drum machines.
The good people
didn't
use
them on records.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So he says, there's something about this groove that, you know, with it insistent like that, I can fit. He was a real, he understood groove unlike anyone I've ever seen. But he goes, I can wrap my voice around that in a lot of different ways for the phrasing of any particular song we
phrasing.
Do.
He had amazing. He was like a real, like almost in a crooner kind of rock singer. You
he
know?
Studied some of the best and picked up some of the best, you know, and then took it to his own place. So we finished that tour. He's off in Japan doing some promo to get ready for the next record. He finds these little machines, the Wasp and the Spider. They're little toys. Black and yellow keys, but they're not really keys. It's just plastic. It just looks like keys. And only about, you know, that many.
Right.
And on each, that's
he's
eight.
Pointing, you know, yeah, eight keys. There you go. Good.
and he brought these things down to Nassau. He lived in the Bahamas.
Right.
He was a tax exile. Chris Blackwell had his.
Now, did you live there then? Or?
Not then. I was living in Los Angeles then.
Okay.
And but Chris had this whole back end of the island set up with villas and places to live and beaches, and it was all our playground.
Was
and
it Compass Point?
Compass Point Studio.
I've been there. I just went and looked at it. I never went and played.
But when
I was
Love
a teenager,
beaches
I was
right
there.
Across
yeah.
the
yeah.
way, and I
yeah.
mean, amazing place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's literally like Bjork. I heard a story aside that Bjork recorded her vocal tracks. They stretched the. You know, the mic cord across, and she did him on the beach.
It doesn't surprise
me. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was living there.
So he was living there, and he played me these things. He was listening to these bass sequences, and he wrote funny, and he had a home studio back then. And I always would listen to his recordings. He called them his demos. And I would go, what are we here for?
Right.
I mean, boom, that pretty much makes a statement. He goes, no, y'all bring a vitality and an energy to it that I really like.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. So he brought me down for the next record. I remember I had this old 1956 11x14 Slingerland marching snare. I don't know why I brought it, but when I recently refurbished it, I found it in storage. It was a mess. And Alex Sadkin was the engineer. Alex went on to do some amazing things with Duran Duran and Foreigner and all kind of people. He killed in a Jeep crash. His Jeep overturned and killed him and there in the Bahamas. Right as his career was
taken off.
He was the engineer, kind of quasi co-producer on the thing. But okay. I go in there with this drum, and Robert had this old Gretsch kit, so I set up the bass drum. I like to do things very simply. You know, you've worked with me. I don't like to put up a huge kit. If I can just do it on a hi-hat, snare, and bass drum, boom, we're good. So I sat those elements up, and all of a sudden, based on that clues thing you were just playing, the sequence is da 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 da. Of course, change, you know, modulating and doing the things that it does, but that's it. That's all I'm hearing.
Right.
I'm like, well, what do you want me to do to it? He goes, play with it. I was like, but, you know, my whole thing with drums is it's a conversation between the vocalist and me.
Yeah.
And not knowing what the song's about. Right. I mean, how do I even begin to play? He goes, it's a musical thing. Just play with it. Have fun. I'm like, well, there's that weird gap in there. He goes, well, do something. Okay. Bap, 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 you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I did the drum track, playing with the damn sequence. Just, they had some great pot down there. So your imagination, it was you're not a problem to go somewhere else. You're right. In the Bahamas, for God's sakes. You know, if you can't find imagination down there, you're in trouble. But I did. I laid drum tracks to all this shit. Gary Newman flew down. He actually flew down. He was in that Escape when he had become hugely famous.
Right.
And he was a pilot. He had his little black plane. And he was flying around the world just to get the fuck away from the press. So he heard we were doing one of his tunes, I Dream of Wires. He flies down and just wants to hang out for a couple of days. And did. And, of course, that was unusual, coinciding with the impetus of this whole thing. Right. I get through with my drum bits. I leave. 8 months later, David Harper, his manager, who also lived in Los Angeles, said, come over to the house. I got something to play for you. And he played me that record. And imagine me having only heard, I call it the Blips and Beeps record, because that's all I fucking heard.
Yeah.
Imagine going from just that to what he ended up with. I mean, he was sequencing shit. He was, there's some Frank Sinatra strings that are backwards on there. Uh-huh. He was sampling things. I mean, this is 1980.
Yeah.
People weren't doing that shit back then. And what was interesting, to get to the point of this whole thing, right. I know it's long-winded.
No, this is what you're here for. That's why we have a podcast. There's no commercial break. There's no time limit.
Yay! So the thing that helped me, the reason I say it was the most important record for me is it taught me one time, and not just time and play with this click track. It's about, in this particular section, move the drum up a little bit. Put the bass drum way back here. Yeah. Now, when it switches to the next section, change those elements around. I mean, you can boss the thing around.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, though, at the time. I was just kind of going along with the game. But all of a sudden, he comes up with a song called Woke Up Laughing, which is on the same album.
Right.
It's an imbutyl. It's three time signatures at once. And they all meet up at the one, but their ones are just different. But eventually they all meet up.
Right.
They all share a one. Say, right. You know, but one's in four, the other one's in 12, and another one's somewhere else.
Right.
And he wanted me to play elements of both beats at the same time.
Okay.
Because he kept changing with his lyric, he said. But of course, I don't hear the fucking lyric, so.
Because you're just playing the thing.
I'm just playing. Dun. Dun, 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 dun. That's all I got.
Right.
He's wanting me to play a funky beat, but he says keep changing to the different time signatures and then incorporate all of them into one. And I told him, I said, you're absolutely insane. I told him this. He should have fired me on the spot, but luckily for me, he liked me and he didn't. But he said, no, mathematically, this works. And I said, I can play it for you all day. And I would sit and play it for him, looking right at him, playing it, making it swing, making it feel good.
Yeah.
Then he'd put that fucking thing, that sequence on, and I couldn't play with it for shit. And I was like, no, it's just impossible to do it. The Africans didn't have that shit, and that's what you're asking me to do. And it just doesn't work with machines. You're crazy. He goes, well, mathematically, it works. So understand that, and you'll be fine. For a week, I called him insane, crazy.
Right.
This ain't going to work. His manager even believed me.
Right.
Started siding with me.
Right.
He insisted and was extremely patient. Like I said, he didn't fire me. And then one day, I'll never forget, I went for a walk on the beach, and then we were in the little car going down to Compass Point to start that day, and boom, that proverbial light bulb.
Yeah.
I found it. Like, oh, if I do that. So I had to go in and go, you know, I'm looking real meek right now. I walked in and was like, I'm real sorry. You're not crazy. And I know how to do it. And sat down and boom, did it right off the bat. But it taught me everything about time and how to maneuver it. So it was very important to me.
I have to tell you this. Okay, before I go any further, and this is really weird that that's the first thing out of your mouth. This is Donnie Wynn.
He's an
incredible musician with an extraordinarily rich history. To me, you've always been a fascinating character as well. You're always inspired.
That's very diplomatic of you, Johnny.
Well, no. I mean it honestly. Like, you know, you came to town and you play with a lot of the best people, and you keep your you always keep your ears open and your mind open and your heart open to new stuff, which is something that after people are in this business for a long time, they remember how it once was when they felt the very best when they did it. But you found a way to continue feeling good with everything that you're doing without lamenting
style
that it's
kills.
Not the past, you know?
yeah, style kills. And I try to, well, you guys, I mean, I've learned so much by being in Austin. I mean, working with cats like yourself, and I'm not just saying that, it's true. Y'all have made me a much better player. I had some basic skills when I came here.
Right.
But I only became the drummer I wanted to be 2 years ago.
Right. Well, see what that is? There's a guy that, like, you know, you're playing. I mean, seriously, that there's not a lot of people with that sort of humility and openness. And I mean, to me, it's the only way you're going to keep on working and actually stay happy and alive in what you're doing. Mm. And it's a big inspiration to other people. Mm. Not just me. And so to get to what you were just talking about, your drummer, and I've worked with you on projects that I've produced. We've recorded together. We've played shows together. I love playing with you. You have an incredible inventiveness. And the other night, I'm in a cover band called Skyrocket. I don't know how much I've talked about that on here yet, but I was driving home with my friend Kyle Crusham, who works with you a lot as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In a late night drive.
He's in Skyrocket, too?
Yeah, he's in Skyrocket.
A bunch of bad motherfuckers in that band.
I know. It is. Seven bad motherfuckers. Anyway, so we're driving back and we were talking, I can't remember exactly about how we got to the two drummer thing, and then we got to you and talking about how, you know, you would be a great drummer to play in a band with two drummers because you have this unique perspective. Well, it's unique. We felt that Charlie Sexton and you both approached the drums with two drum tracks in mind. So essentially the story you just told, you lay something down and it's not just a click track for you to play to. Sometimes I've seen you lay it down when we record stuff. You'll go like, oh, let me do this here and then I'll do another track. And when you're listening to what you're laying down initially, you're like, oh, that's either like so simple or it doesn't quite make sense. And then you lay this other track down that makes this gigantic rhythm that really, you know, moves and so it's interesting that you opened with that story because I was just talking about that with Colin. I find that to be a very unique trait to you and to Charlie. Like both of you guys think in terms of be it a drum machine and a drummer or but like both of those things.
Yeah, Charlie is I listen to things he plays on and it's like, damn it, motherfucker sounds like me.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the thing, is we're both, like, you know, philosophically, and you both have a lot of soul, and you're listening to the song.
I think he's a damn good drummer.
Yeah, I do too. I think he's fantastic. You're from Louisiana. You were born in Louisiana.
Born in Memphis, but raised in South Louisiana.
When did you move to Louisiana?
Four.
When did music first speak to you?
When I was one.
Really?
Yeah. We lived in Memphis, in 1956 when I was born. Again, that dates me. I am double nickels these days.
That's all right.
Okay, I'm cool with it.
You are cool with it. And you know what? That's you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing sadder than someone that isn't. And that's what I mean. You stayed open. You're not grumpy about shit. And you've got, you know what I mean? You're really happy to be around just like you probably were when you were 23.
I think so. I try to keep an upbeat life force in me. It seems to exist to me whether I want it or not. So I'm good with it.
So you're one, you're in the swamps, 1 o'clock, fighting alligators.
The 56, of course, Memphis was shit hot, and Elvis, and that's, it's all coming out of there. It's the center of the musical universe. My mom and dad are right out of high school, had me. So they're still really young. So one day, and I'd always been wondering about this thing that sat over in the corner, this thing, I could touch it, and it would move around and around, and these things would go up and over. What does this thing do? Right. I never heard it. I didn't know what it was, its function. And then one day, Dad brought home these two 45s. Never forget it. Both of them had white sleeves, 45s. That dates us again. Mm-hmm. One had a purple label, and the other one had a blue label. Well, he put the blue label one on first. And he puts it on the machine, puts a little thing over, then hits this button, and all of a sudden, this thing starts turning by itself. And all of a sudden, man, this thing drops down, and all of a sudden, this other thing picks up and goes over, and you hear that sound. And I was mesmerized. It's like, this machine, this is, it's doing something. Yeah, what it's supposed. All of a sudden, boom, all shook up by Elvis Presley comes out. I was stunned. I mean, yeah. It was like this is the most magical thing in the world. I went right to the beat, and it was, I couldn't get enough of it. Dad played it 7 or 8 times before he goes, let's listen to the other one. So he puts on the purple one. Fats Domino, I'm Walking.
Jesus Christ.
First two things I ever hear in my life.
So you were born with rock and roll. You were like right in there.
In my blood from day one because I was drawn right to it. And then my aunt started giving me drums at age 3. I don't know why. I never asked for them. She was a self-taught pianist in the church there, my dad's older sister. And she just started sending drums. I kept playing them, you know. And yeah. Next thing you know, I'm getting a Sears. You know, we've graduated from toys to an actual snare drum now to a Sears and Roebuck Blue Sparkle kit. It kept,
yeah,
things kept getting more. And I always played music. When I was 11, I was playing in bars wearing fake mustaches.
Yeah, that's,
you know. So I've always played music.
How did you get in? Did you how did you end up in a band that was playing a bar? Were they teenagers or
something? Told me I was always cocky, you know. I always knew that I had something going on, you know, and I was applying myself. I wasn't just, you know, barking, you know. I was, you can ask any of my neighbors, they had to endure me,
yeah,
playing hours every day on that fucking kit in the bedroom. My mother, she's a saint because of it, you know. But someone told me one day, I'll never forget, we were in the car going on this big street through the middle of town. They pointed at this house. They said, see that house right there? That's James Cole. He's the fucking best guitar player in the state. He's unbelievable. Really? What's he doing? Well, he's kind of in between bands. He got married, da 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 da. Okay. Next day, I got on my little bicycle with the banana seat. And I pedaled my little young ass over there, and I knocked on the door. And he opened the door, and he goes, can I help you? I said, I'm your new drummer for your new band. And he goes, what do you mean? I was like, I'm here because I'm the new drummer in your new band. He looked at me and he goes, wait a second, you're fucking serious. I said, I'm dead fucking serious. I paddled all the way over here on this fucking bike.
Yeah.
I don't know how many miles to tell you this. He goes, well, come on in. Let's talk about this. We put together a band, won all sorts of battle of the bands. The very first major gig we have, a competing band turned me into the ABC board, and they showed up and kicked me out, and then I had to quit the band because they were all 20 and everything, and that was my last date with them. But I had the nuts to go over and knock on what was considered
amazing.
The best guitar. But something told me to do that. It's like, if you're going to get anywhere, go be with the best.
Right.
And if that motherfucker's the best, well, then go knock on his door.
Was it a real musical area, too, when you moved to Louisiana?
God,
it's
rich.
They're just,
my God, yes. Clubs everywhere, you know. Like there is here. Yeah. Baton Rouge, Lafayette, Jennings.
But where were you living at the time?
In Alexandria at the
time.
Okay,
yeah.
And this is before I went down to New Orleans. It's a strange little town. It's right on the Red River, right before where the north turns to Rednecks and the south turns into Coonasses.
Right.
It's right there on the divide. It's a very bizarre place.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, oh God, yes, there's clubs everywhere. And because I was the young hotshot, I got picked up by a lot of the big G.G. Shin, some of the big Cajun band leaders at the time. He went on to be in a band called Chase later on, but yeah, and there was just great players everywhere. And we all kind of knew that we were doing something. You know, we didn't think we were just kind of fucking around.
Right.
And pretty much all of us that graduated from that time and era went on to go do big things. The guy I moved to California with was Bobby Kimball, the lead singer Toto.
Right.
Randy Jackson.
Rewind. So that guy's a great singer. And I love that kind of voice. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? The high rock and roll. Like,
he was a Donny Hathaway.
Blues kind of.
That was his thing. He listened to Donny Hathaway a lot.
Were you guys in a band together or something?
Yeah. Two bands together in Louisiana. G.G. Shin,
right,
which had Edgar Winter's White Trash horn section with us. Julius Farmer, who was Ron Carter's student at the time.
Okay.
Who went on to great fame in Italy. And then Bobby and me, and I forget who the guitarist was.
And is this the late 60s or so?
Early 70s? Late 60s, early 70s, yeah.
And when did you move to L.A.?
Moved to L.A. when I was... I graduated from high school early. I realized when I was a sophomore in high school that they weren't giving me anything that I needed. And I was, every Friday afternoon, I would leave school and drive to New Orleans and stay with this friend of mine who was a well-known prostitute who ended up being a brothel owner later on.
You're so fucking cool, dude. Like, seriously, this is exactly what I dreamed of when I started this podcast.
She would let me stay at her crib. She had this amazing 4-story crib down the French Quarter.
Right.
And every weekend, from sophomore through to halfway through my senior year, that's where I went and spent every weekend in New Orleans. She let me stay free. Of course, she knew everybody because of her profession, all the musicians, all the restaurateurs. So I was getting just amazing treatment, you know. I was like their little mascot and shit. But I was getting an education. And people say, where'd you grow up? I always say New Orleans.
Yeah, because that's where I grew up. Yeah, that's where you came of age.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, she introduced me to a whole bunch of things. And growing up in Louisiana, yeah, we were all playing in different bands. Randy Jackson, the guy on American Idol, he was a bass player with Sweet Pepper at that time. There was just a whole bunch of us, and we all knew we were good, and yeah, we all went on
to. And you guys all hung out together?
Yeah, played in different bands, similar bands, competing bands. There was bands everywhere back then. Everywhere, clubs everywhere, and they paid really good, and people believed in music, and so they came out, you know, they weren't worried about the new phone, you know, they didn't care about that.
Right.
So they supported you.
They were living.
It's awesome. It was an awesome time to grow up when the music mattered, you know, when people really cared and they supported it in a way that they still do, but just not as many of them. Their attention is diverted elsewhere.
Right.
That's understandable.
Well, even though we have made such great strides, and you can look just at something as simple as YouTube, where you say, like, you know, you can think of almost any performance that was filmed.
Yeah. That's phenomenal.
By any band, you can watch it. You could. It is phenomenal in one sense, but it takes away the Beatles on Sullivan. That's gone.
The magic,
like this apex where everything changes for everyone at once. You know what I mean? No one's doing that with, you know, Bieber's performance on right. YouTube. And I don't mean that to down Justin Bieber in any way, but I'm just saying it's such a different time that the only real recollection I have of this is really a pathetic musical thing, but I was super into Kiss, and in fourth grade, my mom a lot of times just like, you know, no TV, so we wouldn't have a TV or anything. Mm-hmm. So it was horrible, especially when Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park was premiering, you know. Like, how was I going to be one of the biggest Kiss fans in school with all the records, T-shirts, paint my face when I go home? I had, you know, a whole Kiss thing, and I was ace and all my band friends and stuff, and so I had to go to my aunt's house to watch it, and I mean it was just such a thing that if I didn't see it, I felt like I was gonna miss out so much. So to me, this band was such a treasure. Like all the actions that I had, you know, it was a treasure.
Mm. Oh yeah,
I mean it was, and you kind of lose that.
Well, there was mystery back then.
And there was mystery, yeah.
You know, the only way you could see the band was to go see them in concert.
Yeah.
If they came within 300 miles of
you. Yeah, or you had maybe two pictures in a magazine or something.
Cream magazine, you know, a couple, Circus. Yeah, there's Circus. A few other ones, you know. But, you know, that was the thing is word of mouth. I remember Grand Funk Railroad appearing at the Atlanta Pop Festival. No one had ever heard of Grand Funk Railroad before that. And the next day, everyone was calling everybody.
Yeah.
You know, there was no emails or shit. Everybody was just calling everybody going, fuck, I heard this band.
Yeah.
It spread like wildfire, and they became huge overnight off of one little thing.
Yeah.
And that was the thing is when a band came out with a record, it's all you could talk about when they were making it is, you know, they're making this record. You can't wait.
Yeah.
You know? And then it comes out, and you just can't stop listening to it, and because it's the only connection you have.
Right.
And then they go on tour. Well, you got to go see it.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't, you miss out.
You miss out.
There's no other chance.
Yeah, there's no way someone's going to show you half the show from their phone or anything the next day.
So it has demystified it things has demystified to a large things. Degree, and I think that was part of what made it really cool.
Yeah.
Sometimes everybody thinks having access to everything is the greatest thing. Well,
it is in a way, and it's not in other ways.
Yeah. In creative things, I'm not so sure. I like the tech. I like the tools.
Yeah.
You know, I can use the tools. You can use the tools, you know. But as far as the majority of the republic, you know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. I really do. I think, you know, people say, well, man, those are the good old days. And I hate that. Because
you're not one of those guys.
I think
right now
is the good old days. Right now. Yeah. I mean, even with all the crazy shit going on. It's interesting times, you know, and there's lots of cool things happening, and you have the ability to make music and do things and have podcasts and things that never existed before.
You can make your records we can make a record here in my house right now.
I think it's great. Yeah, and you have. The thing we did with Schwa was amazing. Yeah, yeah. It was in your bedroom. It was incredible. So, yeah.
So, This is so awesome. I'm sorry. This is really like when I set out to do this, it takes, you know, a lot of effort, but this is exactly what you want. And I'll tell you, It wasn't just Crush 'Em, but a lot of people, when I'd say, I'm thinking about starting doing this, a lot of people said, dude, you got to get Donnie. And I was always like, oh yeah, totally. You got to get Donnie.
That motherfucker won't shut up.
No, it's great. And your take on the world, that's why your musings online are all so interesting. Mm-hmm. Your ability, like when I went to your website and I started watching this film where you start sort of, what was it, pontificating on the importance of being a rhythmist, and I was like, well, he's not really going to go on this, you know, bullshit fucking I'm this guy thing, and then a pie comes in your face, and I was like, God, that is exactly what I love about him, because you do have the passion and the knowledge of that kind of stuff, but you don't have to take yourself so seriously. So you and Bobby Kimball are moving to L.A. Let's go back to there.
Bobby, yeah, he had actually gone out a few months earlier and was with this band called SS Fools, which was Three Dog Night, but without the singers.
Oh, okay.
It was the whole Floyd, Joe, all of them, Michael. I forget the organ player's name, but yeah, they were at Richie Podler's place. You know Richie. He's the best pop producer of all time, Marshall Crenshaw, the Go-Go.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Anyway, they were at his joint. He did all Three Dog Night records there in Studio City. And I don't know, that band had problems. I mean, there was a lot of heavy ego, Joe Shermy didn't go, I think he's dead, bless his heart, but he wouldn't go anywhere unless a limo took him somewhere. He didn't drive. It was the real rock star thing. You know? And so there was a lot of, Floyd didn't want to do anything but go polish his Bentleys, collection of Bentleys. You know?
So guys that were sidemen then were really making that kind of money where they had multiple Bentleys and shit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. And that's what, from playing sessions and then just touring around with Three Dog Night?
Was a different kind of thing. That was a band.
Yeah.
It was an actual band. And so, yeah, they were treated as equal parts.
Oh, equal parts. Okay. Well, that's interesting because to me, I always thought it was like...
Yeah, you would think, but in those days, everybody got cut in.
That's awesome.
So there was a lot of internal problems, and then of course the biggest session guys in town would eventually be called Toto, and they were putting this band together. They heard how good Bobby sang, Jeff Porcaro in particular, and was like, "There's our singer."
Now were they were already doing a lot of sessions?
Huge sessions everywhere.
They were kind of like the second generation of Steely Dan, right? Like those kind of guys.
They were the guys after the Wrecking Crew.
Right. Okay. Okay.
They're the guys after the Wrecking Crew because they start out with Seals and Cross, Diamond Girl, all that shit. That's them. That's Toto.
That's smooth.
Yeah, they were doing everything. Of course, the big breakthrough was the Boss Gags records.
Yeah, and that was them too.
Yeah, they were. That was Toto. And then after that, CBS basically said, "Put a fucking band together and get a good singer, and you got whatever you want, basically." And they did.
You and Bobby moved there together? Did you know anyone when you moved there?
He only was meeting people as he was going along, like Three Dog Night guys. Then all of a sudden, of course, when you're knowing Jeff Porcaro and David Paich and those guys, you knew everybody in town.
Right.
I mean.
Because they came from, was their dad or something?
Oh, huge session guys in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
Huge. Marty Paich, big film scorer. Joe Porcaro, huge session drummer, you know, I mean, yeah, that's what their dads did.
How exciting.
So it's only natural they handed it down to them, you know, and they were also very talented.
And then also there's probably a level of comfort going into the studio, you know, in those days where you play on three different people's records in one day and you don't, you know, there's no rehearsing. You just go in there and kick its ass.
Yeah. I mean, they were just, here's a funny little aside. This is how big and talented these guys are. Quincy Jones writes over to David Hogg, we call him the Hogg Manor, that's his house. He wrote to the Hogg Manor and says, you know, Michael Jackson's looking for some songs. Would you mind sending over some things? So David, in his bleariness, I'll just leave it at that, in his bleariness, found a couple of cassettes, threw them in a sack, sent them off. You know, Quincy called him about 2 weeks later and says, fuck yeah, man, there's one on here that Michael is all over it. And, yeah, we're going to do it. He goes, well, which one is it? He goes, I don't know. There wasn't anything written on the cassette, but it goes like this.
Right.
Human Nature.
Right. And those guys played on that record,
David's
too, right?
Like, yeah, and David's like, Human Nature? What? I didn't write that shit. Come to find out, Steve Porcaro, who would sometimes crash there, went and one night just hooked up and went into the studio and wrote this thing and then put it, just found a cassette and just went and put it on there. not knowing it was David's work cassette. So it was completely by accident.
Right. That was like the 18th top 10 single off of a Thriller.
But that's the kind of fuck-ups those guys had. I mean, they were on top of the world. And so through them, I met everybody in L.A., you know.
So you went there, and what did you? Would you just go out, or did you answer ads in the paper?
Well, what
happened like
was, is my dad had a bunch of businesses in South Louisiana. Uh-huh. They were mine. He says, you know, by age 28, boom, they're yours.
Okay.
I would have been a very wealthy man. Dealerships, Avis rental cars, gas stations, insurance companies, real estate companies, all kind of shit. What? My dad was a businessman.
Yeah.
He was good at it. And it was all mine, and I had gotten fired on a gig. A bunch of the New Orleans big guys came to Studio in the Country in Bogalusa, and Apple Records was financing it, and they flew over their head engineer guy, Cy Frost was his name. He was signed to Apple as well, and I found out that day I had chops for days. I had zero meter. I had zero pocket. Right. They kept putting a click track on me, and I'd fuck it up. And finally, they had to fire me. All right, we got to move on with this record, dude. We heard you were the shit, so we hired you, but you ain't got shit for pocket. I was dumbfounded, man. I'm back in the tape room, and they play this Barbara Mandrell record, and the fucking groove is a mile wide. And I'm like, that's what they're talking about, groove. Who is this? And they said, Larry London. I'm like, who in the fuck is Larry London? He goes, well, you need to check him out. He's really good. Trying to find out this guy's like, he became my mentor later on in life.
Did you
we
go
became
find
friends.
Him? You went and sought him out?
Oh, we became friends, yeah. I met him through Bob Babbitt, the legendary Motown
right,
player.
Right.
I'd done some stuff with Robert, and through him I met him. But, yeah, and so these I quit playing for several years and just went to my bedroom and put Feats Don't Fail Me Now by Little Feet, a couple of Steely Dan records, all the Aretha Franklin catalog. I found groove guys.
Right.
And I learned, like Hunter Thompson, when he wanted to write, he wrote, I think, The Great Gatsby. Yeah. Word for word.
Right. Yeah.
He could understand the rhythm and why. And I kind of did the same thing with music. I learned lick for lick all those records, especially Feats Don't Fail Me Now. That was like my Bible.
Right.
And then one day I'm at my father's dealership and I'm just bored shitless. I go over to have a joint with the owner of a studio. He plays me stuff by Leo Nocentelli, and it was funky, but rocking. And I had never heard anything like that. Leo Nocentelli's a guitar player for the Meters.
Okay.
And I asked the studio owner, like, I know that you playing drums. He couldn't play drums very well, but his heart. And I was like, can I put some drums on this? Yeah. He goes, well, by all means. Yeah, go ahead. So I did. And 2 days later, Leo Nocentelli drives on the lot. What the fuck are you doing here? You know, you have a gift. Right. You need to be doing it. So I was already feeling bummed, so I went to Dad, and I was like, I'm moving to L.A. tomorrow. And he says, great, go be the best you can be. I'll give you $500 a month from the company. You got a year. At the end of the year, come on back. It's waiting on you. It's yours. Yours. But go be the best you can be.
I like the timeline, though.
And I hope it works out for you. So I go out there and meet Larry London at a NAMM show, and Jeff Porcaro loved me and believed in me. So they're getting me all these auditions. Larry Carlton was great. He was like, you know, I see what Jeff sees in you.
But it's like you were, I mean, you weren't just like answering ads in a paper and going in someone's garage.
I mean, you were
like trying to fucking play with Boz Gags and Chaka Khan and shit. I mean,
Larry
like,
Carlton, yeah.
It was a huge gig. So sorry, Larry Carlton.
Yeah, so Larry, you know, guitar player on everything, all the Steely Dan shit.
Yeah.
The guy's credit list is amazing. A sweetheart of a guy. He said, you know, I see what Jeff sees in you, but I'm going to be honest with you. You're just not seasoned. He goes, I need someone for this band who's seasoned. You're not that guy. He goes, it doesn't mean you won't go on to do something. So all I can do is say, please keep on. Best advice I ever got in my life. But 2 weeks before I'm due to go back to Louisiana.
Oh, right. You're 11 months time's and two
out.
Weeks into it.
Boom. It's done. Well, my friends, the little prostitute in New Orleans hears about this and goes, oh my God, we got to have a party. So she buys me a ticket.
Like a fuck-a-thon.
Yeah, exactly. She says, I bought you a ticket. Get your ass on the airplane. And in those days, she had to kind of pull to where she could pull the limo up to the plane. I didn't have to go through the terminal. Boom, I just walked right into there. They threw a Quaalude in my mouth, gave me a thing of blotter acid to take later, popped a thing of champagne.
So awesome.
And then handed me a ticket to go see Robert Palmer that night with the Meters opening. I was like, that guy's pressure drop, man, that record was brilliant. He's like my favorite fucking artist. He uses Little Feet as his backing band and the meters.
Right.
And the fucking guy has the most amazing rhythm sections and chooses the best songs. Fucking, he's a great singer. Fuck, I can't wait. So we go to the show, great show. Leo comes to me afterwards and says, man, we'll get together at the house. Robert's looking for songs for his new record. I want to play him some of that shit you played on. I was like, great. So I go over there. It's over in Ninth Ward, no longer. And Leo's house, and me and Robert, the only two. He pulled up with this girl. She had a huge white Cadillac with big white fins. It was a beautiful thing, and she had amazing red hair. I mean, she was something. We were the only white people there, and he played the first song, and Robert looked over at Zigaboo, a very famous drummer for the Meters, and said, right. Great track, Zig. And Zig, ain't me. Second track, same thing. Third track, same thing. So he goes, well, who in the fuck is it? He pointed at me. He goes, that's Donnie Wani. That's what they call me. And Robert looked at me, and he goes, but you're white. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
you're just white by skin
color. Yeah, he was amazed. He goes, but you're white. You're like, this is not making sense. Right. I left, went back home, I'm packing my shit 2 days before I'm due to be on that plane going back home. The phone rings, hello, this is David Harper, I represent Robert Palmer, what are you doing today? I'm packing up, I had a year to do it and it didn't work out, so I'm going home. He goes, well, I got a flight for you this afternoon. I'm like, where? Well, Robert lives in the Bahamas.
So your life was going from like flying home with your tail between your legs to work in your dad's dealership to going to the Bahamas.
And he said, and I turned it down. I turned him down. Yeah, I was like, man, I am flattered as fuck, one. I said, but that guy uses Bernard Purdy.
Right.
Zigaboo, Richie Hayward, Alan Schwartzberg, Ed Green. I mean, I just went down the list. I know this guy. He uses the best in the world. I said, from what I understand, I've got potential, but I'm not there yet.
It's called Larry Carlton, Mike.
So, yeah, you don't believe me. Go check. Well, so he says, well, I don't know what to tell you, but Robert heard something he liked on these tracks you played on with Leo. And the flight's bought. He goes, I'll tell you what. He goes, I appreciate your candor.
Right.
But he goes, let's just look at it like this. Come down here. If it don't work out, spend a week on the beach on us as a thank you. And just hang out before you go back to work. But you never know. It
may
work out. I'm like, what time is that flight?
Right. And what year is this?
1978.
Okay.
78. And I was on that flight. And imagine landing and I walked in his house and they were making Indian food and there was some Polynesian music playing and then some Urdu shit and then there was some throat singing and I was just like, where have I landed? It was like being around a bunch of science fiction characters. I mean, I'd never met anybody like this before, but he and I, boom, hit it off from second one as if we'd known each other all our life. And then we finished dinner and he goes, well, why don't we go over and play a little bit? And I'm like, oh, fuck. Here we go, God damn. I hope I'm ready, man. We walk in, the very first song was In Walks Love Again, and it's a second line tune, which is a New Orleans rhythm of which,
right.
Unless you've grown up there, and eating the food, sweated, even if you try to play it right, the people from there will notice you're not doing it right.
Right.
I knew how to do it right. I was working with Dr. John, I forgot to tell you, when I was in high school. So I knew that shit in and out. And so I nailed it first take, and Robert said, welcome. And that was pretty much it. And 25 years later, he passes, but we worked until he died. So, yeah. An amazing education. I mean, good Lord. And the drag for me is most people only know about him through the press, which is the song, the girls, and the video.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
And the suit. Excuse me. Let me throw the suit in there.
These are all like iconic sort of things that people could latch onto at that time.
But that's all the press talked about.
What you're telling me about him and his depth of knowledge of music and his vision of what he wanted when you were talking about the first story where he came in with the little machine that played those things. He was a visionary.
Oh, without
which
a
is
doubt.
Not which is not that's not the guy I saw standing in front of the models in the suit singing the
Right. And that was just a complete he
oh shoot.
All right.
I was the guy that didn't turn off my phone.
It's a great ring, though.
Thank you.
Can't miss that.
So, sorry.
Fine. But yeah, he was.
That's not the guy I thought he was. I didn't think he was a musical visionary. I thought he was. I didn't know what he was. I thought maybe people. But he wrote his songs.
Well, he started when I got with him. It was beginning of a brand new chapter for him, and that he had always covered other people's material very well. People think Spanish Moon is still his. It's not.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, he was just starting to write, and he was a well-read guy. I mean, him and the keyboard player were responsible for turning me on to great literature, which made me want to write. I mean, Robert opened the door. Good clothes, good food, wine, champagne, travel, just literature, art. Everything. This guy was
the finer things.
He was amazing.
At that point, how successful was he? Was he like a?
Well, he was largely successful in a small kind of but growing circle. He had rabid fans,
right?
People that loved Little Feet and the Meters. They were all over him, you know. And he had signed a 25-year deal with Blackwell, so Blackwell basically financially bankrolled him until he went into the black. But he also signed a
25-year deal.
Yeah, and I was with him the day it was up, too. It was a very interesting day. But yeah, Blackwell just running money. You know, like, keep at it. You're good.
And he changed his shit all the time.
All the time. Yeah, and Blackwell was awesome. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better guy to be in your corner. You know?
I can only imagine.
Yeah, he would just give him money. I mean, Robert turned the record in one time, and he was like, no, I hear what you're trying to do, but you're just not there. Go do it again. Here, forget this. Here's a check, $250,000. Here, go do it again.
He really believed in him.
Oh, huge.
Like a special artist.
Yeah. And Robert, you know, we toured playing to theaters, real nice theaters, and they were always sold out. I mean, we had a fan base.
Yeah.
And an international one at that, because we didn't suffer from the same things that a lot of people suffer from, which is a record company telling you how to make a record.
Right.
Chris, hands off. Now, Robert's manager, David, was very hands-on, and he rode us with a fucking bullwhip, you know. I mean, he was rabid about getting it right.
Right.
He started out with the Doors and ended up working with Bob Marley and all. That was kind of his pedigree.
He
had his shit together. He was also a visionary. So, yeah, we had no one telling us how to make a record. So we would make whatever we felt like making, which was that weird Clues record, you know. Right. And
well, first
America
record
didn't
you
get
made
it, but it did great everywhere else.
Yeah.
So we had an international fan base that was great. So anytime we toured the whole world.
But you guys did have, but when you went and worked with him was after he was doing that meter stuff, 1978, then you guys went in and made the record in at Compass Point, the record before Clues, which was called what?
Secrets.
Secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a doctor.
That's
all. Let me ask you a question just from playing with you and a question I've had the whole time.
Mm.
Was that your idea, the stomping kick drum through the thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Robert.
So
had,
signature.
Robert came up with a da-da-da-da-da-da.
All right.
He liked that.
Yeah.
He wanted that feel. So I was really into Charlie Watts at the time.
It makes for such a. It grabs your attention.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And was he who produced that record? You were just saying it was the guy that had worked with the Doors, or he produced it.
He produced that record. Yeah.
And so how did that do? That was a hit in the United States, wasn't it?
That song did really well.
And you guys toured for how long? Did you like a year or something?
We were out for like a year and a half.
All over the world? Or,
Yeah. Every tour he did was all over. Because he had done things that were successful everywhere. Like I said, if this record didn't hit the States, well, it was big in Europe and big in Australia.
Yeah, that's... To me, the European artists I've ever met that are more famous and do well, their view is of a world.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, everyone wants to do well in the States.
Yeah.
But they...
It's the biggest market.
Like,
but.
You know, yeah.
But yeah, it's...
They understand that you can sell a shitload of records in Egypt. Like, well, they have a profound, you know.
Yeah, well, the guy who wrote Bad Case of Loving You, Moon Martin,
uh-huh.
John Martin is his real name, but uh-huh. Moon, makes a living in France. Makes a living, a very good living, just selling records in France.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a whole big world out there. If you're not doing it here, we'll go somewhere else. Look at Hendrix. He went over there and said, fuck it, I'll go over there and do it.
Exactly.
And Europeans and the Japanese, they look at things, they appreciate our art form, where we kind of don't, which is kind of odd. It's our art form, but yeah, we don't care about it like they do.
Yeah.
But they've tried to duplicate it, and they can't.
Right.
So they really appreciate and cherish what we bring, which is why, you know, we're still going over and touring a lot.
Yeah.
perfect thing. I'm glad they appreciate it.
Yeah. So but, you guys, on that tour, were you headlining? Do you headline some places and
did a couple of things to fill in dates, I think. And it was the last time we ever did it. But I remember opening for Blue Oyster Cult in Johnson City, Tennessee. First off, it's like, Blue Oyster Cult? Really?
You know, yeah, that's a weird combo.
Fucking bizarre. We go on stage. I shit you not. First song, man, I see Robert duck. And a full bottle of Jack Daniels hits my riser. And goes on, Robert turns around to me. And we're done. We are out of here. You know.
Wow.
So it was shortly after that that it was like, either we go do theaters and it's our night, or fuck it, we're not going to do it. So we quickly went to that.
And so then you did that for a year, you went back to Compass Point in the Bahamas and made Clues.
Yeah, that's where we did the next two records, Pride and then Riptide. We're all done there in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
So
what with Clues? Like, to me, that was a hit because it played on MTV, but I was at the age then, you know what I mean? Where, like, if it was on it, I loved everything that was on MTV, and mostly because it was giving me, you know, at that point, I lived in a suburb of Houston called the Woodlands, but a lot of the rock radio and all that shit was like Molly Hatchet. And while that's good and stuff, I
38 Special.
Yeah, I was excited for something new, you know what I mean? And then there was a, you know, you, I saw MTV in that summer of 19.
Is that the one he danced on the xylophone?
Yeah, it's the one where he danced on the xylophone. Everything's
bigger
than him. It's real kind of silly. Yeah,
it's very silly. Yeah.
And very much like you know, like when people were like, if you didn't have a performance video, then the concept. No, I guess no one could really think of a concept that they could fill in 3 minutes or whatever. You know what I mean? So it's like, well, we'll make everything giant. We'll make him try and dial a giant phone. So to me, that was big, but sometimes I'll mention that song to people and they don't remember it because I don't remember if it was on the radio, because I remember at that point, the radio, all of a sudden, it wasn't as regional or colloquial as it had been before, where you could hear a song by a band the year before, like, there was a band, I remember this, like, distinctly. This song called You Don't Want Me Anymore by a band called Steel Breeze.
Okay.
That was opening for The Who and their whatever.
Okay.
So I had a whole, like, experience. I heard the song. I loved it. I bought the record, and I saw them. And then I went to Miami to see my dad in the summer, and no one had ever heard that band. They'd never played them on the radio there. But then it seems like when MTV came out, then, you know, it wasn't just some friend of yours that said, oh, they played Adam Ant in New York or L.A. It was like, you could watch Adam Ant in you know, Columbus, Ohio, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And it sort of broke down some walls, and all of a sudden the radio, but did
turn
Clues,
people into entertainers.
Yeah. Did Clues cross over and do better than Bad Case of Loving You?
Oh, without a doubt. It was huge in Europe and Japan. It opened up the Asian market to us. They loved it. And, it's oddly enough, the song Johnny and Mary, Johnny's always on.
Yeah.
Ad infinitum.
Yeah.
Ad nauseum. That became Renault, the car, France.
Uh-huh.
They've done over 183 arrangements. That became their song.
Wow.
Renault. So Robert made some good pocket change with that alone, in France alone. Because Renault, it's for. Since then, since the song came out, it's been their theme song for every Renault model.
Wow. Yeah. And then you did Pride.
Then Pride came along, and that was us delving more into sequential things. We actually brought in another drummer, and he and I are doing pieces of the same bit and all sorts of crap. And then we did this, You Were in My System. That was me and Robert. Just, we were bored one afternoon. Oh. And it just had nothing to do. And he had heard this song, and we frequented dance halls when we traveled. They just said, DJ seemed to always kind of know what was going on back then. We heard this funky song by The System out of New York. The black guy and the white guy, I forget their names now. As it turns out, the white guy was down in the Bahamas working on another record. So we were like, you know, hey, why don't we do a version of your song? They hadn't even come out with it yet. We had heard it by a DJ who had access to it.
Oh, okay,
night,
yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was like, sure. You know, so we went over there. farted off, I mean, just in an afternoon. He hit vocal one take, boom, nailed the whole thing. It was awesome. We were like, well, that was kind of a fun way to spend a couple hours. Little did we know that they released it before theirs came out, and absolutely theirs didn't do anything.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we got the jump on them. We didn't do it intentionally.
Right.
Well, it's just the way business was.
Yeah.
It came out, but yeah, totally eclipsed their version.
Wow. So then, what were you doing other stuff during that time, or you were just kind of like playing with Robert, touring with Robert?
Well, I had my own band that was signed to CBS called, I hate the name of it, but it was our name at the time, and it made sense, the Romeos. There was a bunch of friends of mine from Louisiana. We had like a $4.6 million deal. We had a huge deal with CBS.
Well, and who, what was, what, like, when was that, when was that happening? During that time, late 70s?
During the whole time when I was, went out to California, I was doing that as I was working with Robert. We had done these songs in Louisiana at this little studio, and one of my friends, best friends out there, I don't know, do you know King Vidor, the filmmaker?
No.
War and Peace, the champ.
Oh, another champ. Yeah,
he helped invent Hollywood.
Wow.
Well, this was his grandson. He became my friend. And he says, I really believe in this music. It was kind of Stones-ish, you know. Uh-huh. We were really influenced by Some Girls. It was a great record. And so we just wrote these rollicking kind of 70s kind of Stones-ish things. And yeah, he got us a big, big record deal.
Wow.
David, now, here's where things went awry. We were good friends with the guys in Toto and Paige, you know, produced this, but it was just a big party. I mean, that's all the band was about, was a party. That's right. All we did. That's why people hung out with us, because we partied really good. Yeah. And we have this record that Jerry, the lead singer, made later in life, just he and I fucking around his warehouse, the Chateau Recorders that Steve owned. He had put everything into this warehouse, and we were just dicking around, but you look at the Who's Who credits, it's like Kenny Gradney, Bob Glob, James Newton Howard. It's like,
wow.
I asked him, I was like, we didn't pay these people. How did we get them on this record? I mean, it was just one big person after another. He goes, well, they just like hanging out with us.
Yeah.
Ed Cherney was the engineer. Party. Jeff Workman was the engineer.
Wow.
You know, Record Plant was giving us some free time to do overdubs. I mean, people just like us. So that was the party. And yeah, that was ongoing as I was doing stuff with Robert. Yeah.
So were you guys, did you guys have hits? How many records did you
put out? No, we had one record. And rocking, we were huge, huge in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
I couldn't walk down the street without people squealing and calling my name out and pointing out the window. It was, and we played Kane's Ballroom.
Yeah, I love Kane's.
Right?
No, it's in Tulsa, but.
Right.
But there's other. There was another legendary one there. Yeah.
But so that was ongoing. And we did this tour, and Kenny Gradney was our bass player from Little Feet. And I feel lucky to have survived that tour. You know, I mean, it was wild and woolly. I mean, that band knew how to party, and that's what we did. We were good at it. But you know,
what kind of tours did you? Were they just your own, or did you go out opening for like Uriah Heep or something?
No, we went out just doing our own little thing, playing clubs. I don't know how they had it,
like Agora Ballroom kind of clubs.
Exactly.
Kind of those bigger late '70s, early '80s places they had.
Exactly, and you know, seriously affected Rock and Roll and Love and Death was our first single.
Right.
And yeah, they were playing it. Carol Key was playing it. All sorts of people were playing it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was doing okay. But I brought in Steven. I didn't think was a good enough manager. He got us a deal, and I love him as a friend, still do, but he just wasn't the right manager. So I got Dave Harper from Robert Palmer and John Shambody, who was the bass player for Elvis Costello. He was the Clover guy, and he was like a little Jake Riviera. If you know Jake, you know what I'm talking about. Jake Riviera was Elvis's manager, real South London mafioso.
All right.
You know, with the clothes and the whole bit, you know, pointy-toed shoes, two-tone, you know. And so they were our two managers, and they were both just hard asses. You know, I was used to it with Robert. I was used to having the whip cracked, and I appreciated it because it made me be better.
Right.
I didn't need someone around telling me how fucking great I was. I need someone to say, hey, you're sucking, and here's why. Get your shit together. I know which one I'd rather have.
There was a lot of that in the 70s, huh? I bet there was a lot of that. Just people. I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen so much now. I don't know if it's because we've grown up and seen the wake of what really happens if you take everything just too far.
Yeah.
You know, but it seems like back then there was so many missed opportunities because people would just kind of get lost sometimes.
Yeah, there was a lot of sucking really up time. Going on back then. But my boys couldn't handle the pressure.
Right.
And they folded, basically. And so, yeah, I left the band, and that was the end of that.
And so you were still doing Robert Palmer. So then, mm-hmm. then Robert Palmer did a record with the guys from Duran Duran.
Well, that came about in a weird kind of way. We were buddies with them. We hung out and partied with them. Mm-hmm. They were cool guys, especially John. He was just a great guy. And I was hit by a car. I was on my way to the studio to work with Craig Leon, who did all the early Blondie records and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was going to a session with him and got hit by a fucking car in Encino and broke my hip. And so Robert was like, well, we need to push the album back. We can't do it until you're ready. And
so was it just you or the band was integral enough to him to be like an actual band?
I was the only one he kept. Every record was different band members. Every tour was different band members. I was the only one he kept. I don't know why.
Well, it's awesome that you got to have also that connection with him, too. Yeah. You know, you weren't just a hired hand.
No. I was involved with everything. I mean, from album covers to choices of musicians and arranging the songs and everything. I was from start to finish, I was there and privy to that educational process.
Right.
You know, and working with, you know, Bernard Edwards and, you know, Brian Eno and Chris Kimsey. I mean, working with some cool...
What was Brian Eno like to work with? Is he...
He didn't say very much. He was a real behind-the-scenes kind of guy. I'd worked on the Remain in Light, the Talking Heads uh-huh. record.
What did you do on that?
I was just doing some percussion. I didn't even get credited for it. I was hanging out a lot with Chris and Tina then. They're just great people. They lived there. They lived in Tip Top up behind Compass Point. Uh-huh. They have a permanent place there.
Okay.
So we were hanging out. There's, you know, Chris is a great hang. He's a lot of fun. Tina is too. She's a sweetheart. But, yes, it was when we were making Clues.
Right.
They were doing Remain in Light. Stones were there doing Emotional Rescue. And AC/DC
were you guys all hanging out?
Was there doing Back in Black. So we're all hanging out.
What a fucking amazing
We're
time.
All hanging out playing on each other's shit. Yeah, I was jamming with the Stones. I mean, it's just amazing.
do you have any good like, stories?
I was a 22-year-old fucking kid. It was like, wow, what's happening?
Oh, my God.
Here? Yeah, it happened pretty quick.
Wow.
But anyway, back to what happened. I got a broken thing. So he gets a call from John in New York, John Taylor, and he said, we're doing these tracks. We're just having a good time. You know, you want to come up and put some vocals on them? So they posted a cassette to him, and he listened to it on his Walkman. He wrote Something Like It Hot on the plane flight up there. Mm-hmm. And it was just a weekend. They went in and just the tracks were already done. And he just sang to it, and they put it out and pushed.
And Bernard produced that record.
Yeah. Bernard Edwards produced, and Jason Corsaro engineered, who's the best drum engineer on the planet. He's responsible for those huge. Well,
yeah.
He did Like a Virgin, Something Like It Hot, Addicted to Love, Black Hole Sun. I mean, that's all Jason. He's a bad boy.
Wow.
Yeah, he's fixing to do the Knuckle Yummin record.
Really?
Yeah, we're doing some covers. We're going to fly out there and do it with him. It'll be a lot of fun.
That is awesome.
Yeah. Well,
so.
And then we're going to do one with you.
Yeah. I'm going to do one with you. I'm sorry. I just lost.
That's how the Something Like It Hot sessions came about. I couldn't do it. He had a break. He went up there and did it. But that was it. He had no intention of touring behind it or anything.
Right.
It was just fun. It became a huge hit. Now, granted, it brought a lot of attention to him, which didn't suck.
Yeah.
But then the next record, he decides... You know, I really enjoyed singing. I've been producing the last three records, and that's a big hat to wear. I want to be a singer.
So
I heard that from him a lot. So he got Bernard, and then he called me up. He goes, man, you know, he'd had a couple of drinks. He's like, I got some bad news. I was like, what? He goes, well, I've chosen Bernard to produce this new record. He's bringing in his own people.
Yeah.
I was like,
that's
well,
Tony,
got,
right?
Yeah, Tony and Jeff Bova and Eddie Martinez. And, of course, you know, Bernard played bass.
Right.
And something happened. Something happened. I don't know what to this day, but Tony was gone. And then they called me and said, come down. We need you to finish the record.
And what songs did you... Now, that record was... And in fact, I'm going to send this disc to my Uncle Jack. And since shit, I mean, that summer of 86, was it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was like our record. Everything, even the Riptide, Caught in a Riptide. Like everything on that record was awesome to us.
It was a good record. Really good record.
What all did you play on that?
The first, I only remember specifically Discipline of Love. I know I did some other ones.
Why did you do it?
Yeah. And it was funny because Jason had, we were right They had built a long hallway because Back in Black was so loud, they had to build a bunch of doors to stop the sound from coming up. So he had this long, tall, bending down, narrow hallway. So I sat up right in the doorway of the studio.
Right.
Studio's to my back. I'm facing into the hall. And he had mics at like 10-foot intervals all the way down this long, like 50-yard hallway. And there was gates on each one of them. And I had to hit hard enough to set off the gate in that mic, to set off the gate in the next through the chain. I was having a hard time getting the last three to react, so they tied it. We went to the beach and got a rock and taped it to my foot.
Really?
And enabled me to hit hard enough to set off all the things. But once you set that thing off, it created this combustion rhythm like the walls are heaving. I mean,
right.
I've never heard anyone do a drum sound quite like it. He's a genius.
No, and it seems like when you say that, there's... I mean, was Tony, I don't want to go all technical, but musicians are probably listening to this anyway. Tony Thompson was a hard-hitting drummer, right?
Oh, extremely so. But the magic of Tony, because he would play a fill and drop time like a motherfucker. Did it all, you know, Live Aid, just go watch.
Right.
That was his problem. Now, in the studio, they could cut him, and bless his heart, he's not here to defend himself, and I feel bad about it, but I'm telling the truth.
Right.
That they could splice him to make him sound good, you know, just keep away from the fills. But when he would do fills, it would be interesting. But the magic of Tony Thompson was his foot.
Yeah.
Listen to where he puts the foot. In every song he ever played, it's kind of leading everything. Like my magic spot's left hand.
Right.
Well, his foot was his magic thing. And man, that carries the entire fucking track.
If you think about it, like his foot, like defined the dance music of the late 70s that bled into the 80s because all three of those guys were in control of all music that was dance. Like Let's Dance. You know, that's Tony on that record, right?
Yeah, between Niles and Bernard and Tony, there was a lot of shit.
Yeah, dude, like most of the shit you were dancing to that was still rock and pop. Mm-hmm. It was done through them, they really influenced.
Yeah, he was spectacular. I already loved him, and he made me play harder. I mean, that album, doing that record, made me discover a whole new way of playing harder. I grew up in New Orleans, so I had a lot of jazz influences and funk influences that didn't require just smashing the shit out of it.
Yeah.
This is a whole new ball game.
Yeah.
And we had to go support that record. And we used the sounds from that record. So I'm having to trigger things and playing like that. Yeah. I grew from the tour for Riptide. Yeah. I went from a 38 jacket to a 44 fucking jacket. One fucking tour. I was using these big double-butted 2Bs. I call them Serious Business.
How long was that tour?
It was a year and a half.
I imagine. Because that was a huge record.
Yeah. We had the National Anthem of America that summer. It was ridiculous.
You fucking did.
It was ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, we came in from Japan, and we landed in Minneapolis, of all places. Now, how that routing came about, I don't know. But I remember walking down the gateway, and BJ, she was Duran Duran's background singer, and she was singing with us.
Okay.
She came, and I'm her son's godfather. She came running down the hall, we're number one.
Oh, yeah.
I'll never forget it. It's like, oh, wow, okay, this is what it feels like. And yeah, the crowds were amazing, and I had been coming down here a lot, spending summers here in the
Austin?
Early 80s. Yeah, I'd come down here 81 through 83. I spent 81, 82, 83 here, playing with the Staheli brothers.
Yeah.
And John Shambody from Clover was the bass player.
Yeah.
And we just hung out for the summer here. So I loved it, and I remember I was over at the Opry House. You'll remember that.
Yeah, I've seen shows.
And the fabulous T-Birds were on, and they were on.
Yeah.
And I walked away going, that's one of the best fucking bands I've ever seen in my life. So Robert was like, well, who should we get to open this thing, this tour? You know, there's going to be some big crowds. I was like, there is no finer way to open up than the Fabulous T-Birds. We got to get them. And he heard a couple of things. He was like, oh, but of course.
Yeah.
So they came out with us and were with us for quite some time.
And they were having a big year that time, Tough Enough was doing really well.
Yep.
Man, what? So that tour ended. And then what did you do? You went back to L.A.?
Well,
what?
During the making of Riptide, some weird shit went down. That island, until then, was idyllic. There was no crime. None. It was this sweet, sleepy, little, great little place.
Nassau.
Yeah. New Providence, Nassau.
Okay, yeah.
Uh-huh. And apparently, from what we understood, the American government basically told them, they're using the Medellin cartel is using your airport as a port of stop before it goes
other places
to New Orleans or Miami wherever. Cut it out or we'll take all your aid away. So they gave away everything overnight. Just gave it away. And overnight, murders, rapes, robberies. And they knew we were back there on the back end of the island. You know, there's a lot of money and shit back yeah. there. So they would come around their little boats or dinghies, come up to our, you know, our seawalls and go over the seawall, shoot our fucking dogs and take our cameras and all the other shit they could pawn. We had to hire guards to stand outside the door to keep bad people
Holy
out.
Holy shit.
And overnight it changed. Overnight. It was freaky. And Robert was like, I can't live like this. I got to get out of here. So he's a tax exile. There's not many places to go. He chooses Switzerland. And while we're over there, we meet these guys, the La Bionda brothers, who were kind of like Alamo Irving Publishing over there.
Uh-huh.
Some big wigs. And they had bought this TV studio, ChGD. And it was a beautiful, big, open, you know, studio, you know, and a nice little control room. And they basically said, build a studio like you want. Because Robert was getting Swiss citizenship. He had found a place in Lugano he wanted mm-hmm. to buy, which is right on the Italian-Swiss border. Milan's only 45 minutes away.
Just perfect with
no
the
brainer.
Suits.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the food, everything. Yeah, we were Italian freaks. And so we did. We gave them a Christmas list. This is what we want in the studio. Uri speakers, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just everything. Right. Every outboard gear. And a week later, it was there, up and running.
Wow.
So that's where we recorded the next record.
Wow.
And they had hired these brilliant technicians who started, we were using, back then there was no Pro Tools. It was called Radar. This is like 89. And these guys were brilliant at it. You'd go, I want this and this. I'll never forget the first time we were working on it. And I remember looking at it. The first time I'd ever looked at music. And there was this one bass drum beat that was bugging me. And I saw that it was out. I was like, man, I'm a little late on that. Let me go punch this in. And the Italian guy looked at me and laughed. He goes, and just moved it.
And he moved it.
I was like,
wow.
That changes everything. Now yeah. the editing process is... So hey,
fast.
Yeah. No more slicing tape.
Yeah.
Taking that gamble or punching in, you know, and then fucking the punch in up and, you know, all the idiosyncratic hells that go along with that. It was a new world. And these guys, they could move as fast as you could think. And working with them and in that process, it was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But yeah, that was Heavy Nova. And we named that, we were in some club somewhere on the East Coast. And I remember... Robert's like, what are we going to call this fucking thing? We're doing, you know, Heavy Nova all the way to Bossa Nova. And so out of my
Heavy
mouth
Nova.
Came Heavy Nova. Or the other route. And he goes, I like the Heavy Nova better. Boom, Heavy
what
Nova.
What was the, I'm drawing a blank on the hit song off of that one.
Really Simply Resistible.
Simply Resistible.
Yeah.
She's so fine. You played on that whole record?
Yeah. Yeah. Ricky Fattar played on one song. He was the drummer. He is the drummer for Bonnie Raitt.
Okay.
And it was an old dear friend of mine.
So did you guys toured behind Heavy Nova?
Yeah, another big, long juggernaut. Yeah.
Another one.
Crazy, wild.
And by this time, his thing was a fucking machine. So many people
yeah.
living off of it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got to have models in the video. was that weird at all? Like, to not
it
be in the video of the band that
no,
you were in?
Was,
and just like the...
We had absolute disdain for videos. Robert, to do Addicted Love, he showed up, went in there, sang it once, walked out. That was it. Terrence Donovan... Robert was always into fashion and whatnot, but he was friends with photographers like Graham Hughes and knew Terrence Donovan. He was a photographer with all the big, you know, high glossy magazines. He knew all these people. He was in the fashion world, but he, you know, didn't participate. He just knew the people.
Right.
So he called Terrence up, says, they want me to do this fucking video. Would you put something together for me? You know, okay. Robert, you know, Terrence was a real character, big dude. Had 50 of the same suit, 50 of the same shirt, 50 of the same shoe.
Right.
I asked him, I was like, why do you do that? He goes, so I don't have to think about what I got to fucking wear. I think about other things.
Yeah.
Drove a big convertible Rolls. He was a real character. And he, Robert walked in and there was the models and boom, one take and the weird little fluorescent thing around the lens of the camera. If you notice in, the,
yeah.
in their eyes, there's yeah. always this white circle. That's uh-huh. that.
Right.
That's what gives it that glow. And
right.
he had taken that from the fashion world.
The Ring of Fire is what it's called, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, Robert went in, sang one time, and walked out. That was it. And we didn't... I saw the video. I was like, what a load of shit. What a waste of time.
No, well, I saw it and masturbated about 1,900 times because I was 16 or 17 whenever that song came out.
It would become the like, biggest fucking thing. And to the point to where our crew got really tired of that tour of saying, no, the girls aren't here.
Right. That was my next question. Was like, I mean, not that I don't like seeing you, but if I was expecting one of those models and then all of a sudden there's Donnie Wynn, I'd be like,
yeah, it doesn't really. Yeah,
you know, that happened to me with Robert Palmer when I went to, I think I've told you this, in the summer of 85, was before my mom died. I was visiting in Miami and my Uncle Jack and I went to see the I'm drawing a blank. Some Like It Hot. What's that band? Power Station. Why don't you go see Power Station? Mm-hmm. So we were big Duran Duran fans and we liked that record a lot. And we liked Robert Palmer too. And so it's like, oh, awesome. So we go and I guess back then there wasn't like Twitter or like whatever. If you missed the news that this dude isn't going to be on tour and some different guy was going to be singing, it was very strange. And nothing against Michael DeBar. I've actually met him.
Right.
I met him at one of Raji's parties a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I told him that. So it was shocking because at first, because I liked it's such different singers, you know, such different styles and such different personas.
Yeah, Michael liked to jump off trampolines and shit. Yeah. He liked to sing.
He had this real like in your face kind of thing. And Robert really looked like he just kind of walked in, would sing his song. Just like you said, he did in the video and then just walk out when he was done and maybe get in a limousine and go somewhere.
Yeah.
So then after the Heavy Nova, you were living in L.A.?
No. Where were you? This time I had already moved to the Bahamas.
Oh, so you...
Okay. I was living there during the making of Riptide.
Okay.
And then we did another project after that, this film called Sweet Lies. And we did the music for that down there. Then when that finished, Island Records had their 25th anniversary at Pinewood, where they shoot all the James Bond stuff. Uh-huh. We went over there and did... It was a big live show on the telly. And we went and did that, and then from there, he had already moved to Lugano, so I ended up moving to Milan. I was living in Milano Due, which is a little town for entertainment people outside, mainly TV people. And, yeah, that's where I lived for 3 years. Over in Milan, it wasn't so bad. You know, the food was good.
Yeah, I bet.
Clothes were better.
And so what were you doing there? You were still playing with Robert? Were you doing other stuff? Were you picking up other gigs?
We were so busy. I didn't have time to play with anybody else. I really didn't. There was an aborted Wynwood tour that I rehearsed for. We ended up not doing it. It just wasn't working. There was a Blondie tour I was supposed to do. There was different people, but...
A Blondie tour where you were going to play drums? Place?
Yeah, it was... They didn't have only... Deborah and Chris were the original members in it. They were hiring other people at that time. But I never have been one to keep my mouth shut. And I'll make, if something isn't right, I'll say something, you know. And if they don't like it, well, Chris had his 17-year-old girlfriend playing guitar in this Blondie band. Mm. She had her guitar teacher there trying to teach her chords about how to play the fucking songs. I mean, forget about rhythm and everything, sound and everything else.
Yeah.
And I just told Debbie, I was like, this is really an embarrassment, you know, to go out and support this new record you've got.
Yeah.
This shit. She agreed. So they decided to get this guy, Ronnie Drayton, a left-handed guitar player out of Brooklyn, who's really good. And
was that like the French Kissing in the USA era? Was that?
This is like 91. Chris Franz. Oh, okay. So Chris Franz later. Got me the gig because he's good friends with them.
Okay.
It was Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde was the name of the record.
Okay. I didn't hear it.
So, that didn't work out. Chris then blamed me for all of it. He goes, none of this happened until you got here. And so we parted company. So I realized early on that I need to start doing my own thing, you know, and because Roberts was so, I was a part of everything, you know, but it was during the making of this one record in 93 when we realized that we thought we'd made the best record we'd ever made, and the company EMI got bought 2 months before we put the record out. Of course, with new people in, they didn't want to touch anything the old company did, so never mind. And Robert was so bummed out, he called me up, he goes, I'm taking a long time off. The record industry is crumbling. There's something really wrong here. He goes, I'm just going to put out every, you know, greatest hits collection known to mankind and let my catalog work for me, build up some money. And it did. And I happened to be over at his house for Christmas, New Year's. We spent every Christmas, New Year's together. And I was there. He picked up the phone. Hello? Really? Really? Well, thank you very much. I'm on the phone. He goes, well, that was Lionel Conway, my 25-year contract's up today. My entire catalog is mine as of right now. So he ended up getting a bunch of money from Warner Chappell for that.
Jesus.
A bunch of money for that.
Wow.
So, yeah. He just decided he didn't want to play that game anymore, and he saw it coming. And he was smart and right. And then I ended up working with Brooks and Dunn, and then all sorts of weird shit started happening.
How long were you out with Brooks and Dunn?
5 years.
Did you play on the records? And
No, that was part of my beef with them.
Nashville, kind of.
That was part of my beef. When I came in, I said, listen, I'm used to doing the records, you know, and I said, this kind of music, I can play backwards, you know. It's not a big deal. I can do it justice. And so they would let me do all of the demos, and then they would play the demos for the session guy,
right.
And he would copy exactly what I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they needed that country name, you know.
Right. So at that point, you stopped kind of being a part of stuff, and you went into, like, the big game of Sideman and, like...
Yeah, and it sucked.
I can imagine it. You're dependent on these people that...
And run, like, a, you know, military unit, and there was guys pulling power plays, you know, band leaders pulling power plays. I mean, just disgusting crap.
I'm sure there was, like, a music director that wasn't one of the guys... Whatever.
He was there, but he wasn't much of a director.
So, at the end of the Brooks and Dunn, was that your idea to stop playing with them?
Yeah. Well, they were asking me, ironically, Ronnie Dunn was asking me to play more like the records. And I'm like, I play music. I don't know what I'm going to play every night. I'm never going to go so far out that, you know, the song falls apart.
Right.
But I just hear things.
But you're in the moment.
I'm in the moment playing music, you know, and they were like, well, we really want you to play pretty much exactly what the... So we parted company in November. It was decided that this is not the right thing for me. It's not the right thing for y'all. I told them when I left, I was like, either, you know, forego paying a musician and just get a DAT machine and play the fucking tracks and play to the DAT, or find some young kid who doesn't mind playing exactly that every night.
Right.
And I'm sure there's thousands of them out here. And, you know, I'm gone. I'm done. I lost my passion for it totally. Absolutely. And so I quit. I sold everything I had, paid off all my debt, and took a vow of poverty, a serious one, and lived on a friend of mine's ranch and wrote a novel. And didn't want anything to do with music ever again. I was done with it. Didn't listen to it. Nothing.
Wow.
And then
just left in disgust. I was just... That's a hard... I think we all come to that point at some
I hope people do.
A breaking point.
Yeah, I hope you do. I hope everyone does, because without it, you'll never find out what you're really capable of doing. It takes that sock in the fucking gut and getting away. A lot of people are afraid to get away because they feel like people will forget them. Maybe.
Now, what are they going to forget?
Yeah, right. You know, they might not see that you're playing everywhere, but, you know, you come back, it's no big deal. But people are really afraid of that, especially... Side musicians, they're really afraid of.
Yeah, well, you have to. I mean, you're dependent on someone else's decisions for your work and success, and ultimately, you know, your livelihood.
And the thing with Brooks and Dunn, there was a lot more to it than just music. It was, even though I lost my passion for it with them, I told myself I'll have to make music like this to make a living to support this lifestyle that I don't want to do that anymore. And essentially, I looked at my lifestyle. And realized, I thought I was free. I realized I was a fucking slave, man. I was in debt. And I had to work to pay for this debt that I created.
Yeah.
Granted, I was doing fine. It wasn't a problem. Bills were paid. You know, horses in the pasture, they got feed. Everyone's great.
Right.
Got a great house, great girlfriend. Everything's wonderful. I was miserable. And I couldn't figure it out. And then I ran across two quotes. One of them, one was by Thomas Edison. And, no, let me tell you the Bernadette Devlin one first. I'll tell you the Thomas Edison one first. It said, let me see if I don't want to paraphrase it. Let me see if I can get it right. No, I'm going to tell you the girl one first. You'll have to do some editing in here. But she said that to gain that worth having, and her name was Bernadette Devlin. She's a real smart lady. To gain that worth having, it may be necessary to lose everything.
Right.
Wow, okay.
I've heard that. Yeah,
that
resonates
with me. And and Thomas Edison's thing was, and let me think of it. I keep forgetting it. Right. Discontent. Is it something of discontent are the first sure signs of progress? Unhappiness and discontent are the first sure signs of progress. Those two things were like boom. I mean, huge things echoing in my ears, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go with that. And this little voice that tells me to do weird shit, like leave my dad and go play music. That was this little voice that talks to me. Told me to sell everything I had, take a vow of poverty, and go live in the middle of nowhere. And it was important for my growth at the time. And it kind of, I was able to strip myself of ego, which ego Prime was my reason for doing a lot of shit, you know? And yeah. I realized it wasn't getting me anywhere, anywhere, on any part of my life, you know, personal, music, professional, whatever. So, yeah, it was time to strip myself of all. I had on a bunch of suits of clothes that I didn't like. I didn't like the person I saw in the mirror. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
So it was time to go out in the middle of nowhere and just take them all off.
Yeah.
Put them to rest. Get rid of them. Took 6 years, but I finally did it.
Yeah.
And then came to Austin.
Here you are now.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, so here I've learned so much here. It's an amazing place.
You've moved here. You've been playing on people's records. You've been playing mm-hmm. with different artists that you mm-hmm. find interesting. Mm-hmm. We've worked together on mm-hmm. stuff on other people's records, and
yep.
And then you started Knuckle Yummy.
Yeah, Knuckle Yummy was born about of anger. I had played with Pear. Will Sexton called me one day and said, "Man, come over here and play."
Yeah.
And I went over to, I think it was called Freddy's Place, that joint Robert Hovitas. Yeah, yeah. And I walked through the door, and there was Pear, and Will had some drums on their side. He was beating them on the floor, and I was going to go get a cheeseburger, and Will was like, come, sit in. No, I got to, come. Okay. So I went, and from second one, when I hit with Pear, the energy and the chemistry was combustible. I mean, it freaked me out. I hadn't been hit like this. I mean, I could go anywhere, and this guy, I couldn't lose him. And it was terrifying and scary and dangerous, and it was all the things I missed of music. And I told myself then, I told him then, I said, I don't know what's ever going to come of this, but we're going to do something one day. I don't know what. About a year later, and you were a part of this, that Freebirds thing that we did.
Yeah.
Remember when the End of the World storm ended the show?
Yeah, there's actually a video of us doing that on YouTube.
So awesome, that storm, man. You couldn't have scripted that any better.
Yeah, that's what's coming in the video.
Great. But we did an earlier thing with that girl, Elizabeth Lee.
Yeah.
And we were on stage, and she has this guitar player who admittedly, you know, was a blues scholar.
Right.
You know, it just wasn't digging deep for me. It wasn't dirty and crazy.
Right.
But I remember being on stage, and we got into this Appalachian gut bucket kind of thing, and I remember thinking, man, if fucking Pear was there, this would be something. And I just kept that in the back of my head, you know, a year later. Is when we found out that this guy was absconding with the business we were trying to create.
Right.
This guy was absconding with our business patents, basically.
Right.
I guess he thought they were his.
Right.
And it angered me so bad, I just quit. I was like, I've been doing this for 4 years.
Yeah, you put a lot of, there was a company, you know, that was going to do this thing. It was a whole new kind of way of marketing music and stuff. And Donnie went out on a limb and got friends of his involved, myself, mm-hmm. Billy Harvey, a couple of other artists, mm-hmm. and different walks of... Anyway, and then as a lot of startup businesses just end up, somebody takes somebody's idea and runs off with it because they have the means with which to get it done on their own, and selfishness, basically.
Kinda,
greed and selfishness.
Kind of, yeah. And it also had grown past the Austin-centric thing I wanted to do.
Right.
I knew there was something special here.
That's right.
And suddenly he's wanting to do business with AT&T, and there was just not enough music to fill those pipes.
And so this was like 5 years ago.
Yeah. So we caught him absconding with the business patents, and I got so disgusted. I was like, I'm done. I've been at this for 4 or 5 years with no pay, and I'm starving to fucking death. You know, I had a near-death experience. All this shit's going down. I'm like, I'm tired. So I called Pear and Lizzie, and I was like, it's time.
Yeah.
I called Bobby Thomas. I said, you've been wanting to do a studio thing. You've been buying shit. Guess what? Tomorrow we start recording.
Yeah.
What? Knuckle Yummy. What are we going to record? I don't know.
Yeah.
And we showed up, and everybody's like, what are we going to record? I was like, I don't know. Let's just start playing. And we did that whole record in one day and just playing. We had, you know, she's making up shit on the fly. Everyone's making up shit on the fly. And that was our first record. And when I listened back to it, I was extremely pleased. And yeah, it's my little pet project.
Good.
Yeah, we've got 4 records done now. And we use all different kinds of people to show how far that genre can be stretched. And
yeah.
We're doing pretty good. And like I said, one day we're going to work with you. And
yeah.
I'm excited about that.
Man, I've really, really enjoyed getting to know Pear a little bit by little bit throughout the last year or so.
He's an amazing person.
I've really gotten to be around him. He's a great artist.
Yeah.
A great
sweetheart.
Guy. Sweetheart.
You know, heart of gold, you know, and this naive, childlike innocence about him that I really, really like. And a lot of people that get around him, you know, think he's simple.
No, I don't.
And then you have a couple of conversations with him, especially talking about art.
Yeah.
Because he's an art professor. And boom, man, he'll come out with some deep, heavy shit. Yeah. You know? And over time, I've gotten to know him. And yeah, he's just an amazing, deep well. Really understands the rhythms of life, you know, and has applied himself very quietly in solitude of learning to play this way, you know, which is an ancient blues way. It's the way the originators did it.
Right.
He's not trying to be Stevie Ray Vaughan. Nothing against Stevie Ray Vaughan. It's just not that. And he was content to be on the sidelines and in solitude doing it for all those years. I mean, there was 2 years I'd go see him at this club. I was the only one that ever showed up.
Right.
2 years. It was amazing, you know. And so I'm glad we're out doing stuff. It's given him a confidence. And we just did a new record that was just a joke in one afternoon. And you should hear it. It's
really, oh, I'd love to hear
really
it.
Something else. Old, like, Lead Belly songs, you know, the story songs.
Yeah.
And I'm scraping on knives and hitting trash cans. I mean, there's no drums at all.
Awesome.
And it sounds, you hear it and you just, you put a smile on your face. You can't help it. It's just got that sound. And Boo did a great job. He's awesome.
I love that about you. I remember when you came over to my house to do that Schwa album a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't remember if we were listening to something after the drum track, and you were like, "Hey, bring a mic in here. I'm going to play this toaster oven." It's like, and it's a great track on there, you know.
Yeah,
it totally makes the record move.
Yeah.
So, man, this has been really great.
I could sit and blabber for hours.
I know. I could sit and listen for hours. This is so it is totally entertaining, and I know at least a couple of people I know that listen to this are going to find this extremely informative and entertaining. You are. You're a great guy. We're going to have you back. We should have you back as a recurring guest.
I'll come back. I'll spread the hoopy.
You spread the hoopy?
I'll spread the hoopy.
Well, thanks for sharing your story.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've got a new Knuckle? Is the Knuckle Yummy album coming out anytime soon?
Mm-mm. No, this one we're working on right now. We've been in pre-production for it in 6 months because basically Pear had to learn a song.
Right.
Which is unusual for him. Usually I turn him loose.
Right.
And I edit, but I never move shit around.
Right.
You know? But to learn, say, People Say by the Meters, or Freddy's Dead.
Right.
Or Rubber Band Man.
Right.
I mean, we have all these Mississippi Queen. We have all these songs. And the dictum was, I said, you know, to break the rules, you have to learn them. So you're going to have to learn these songs. The exact arrangement, lick for lick.
Yeah.
You're going to have to figure it out. And then once you have figured it out, you got to forget it and then find you in it. And that's going to take a while. So we started last October, and only in the last 3 weeks are we getting there. I mean, it's really, he's finding himself. He's playing the shit out of these songs. I mean, you're going to hear Mississippi Queen and think that's what Felix Pappalardi heard before they ever cut it.
Right.
It sounds like the original thing.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing that. So you, aside from that, you're also playing with Will. You play with Ruby James. You play with Will Sexton. You play with Yahoos.
Patricia Vaughn, Danny Malone.
Patricia Vaughn. Yeah. I love Danny Malone.
Danny Malone's one of my favorite new songwriters.
Yeah, he's great. And he's cool.
Yeah, he's real, real good.
I like hanging out
play with him. Earl Poolball and Casper Rawls and all kind of stuff.
That's good.
When is this coming out?
I don't know. They'll just be...
There's a reason I'm asking.
Oh.
Because I have news, but I can't tell you unless I know what date it's coming out.
It won't be before next week. So, why? Is it this weekend?
There's some big news I can lay on you right now.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
I'll have to tell you in private.
Okay.
I can't do it. They're going to have an international press release 1st of September. And they've asked I keep quiet until then.
I think that's awesome.
But there's... The city of Austin will be very proud.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
something real big and new is fixing to happen here. It's big.
Donnie Wynn, man of mystery, Zen master.
Yeah.
Rhythmist.
Rhythmist.
Pine the face.
That's a good word. And I consider myself that. I don't consider myself a drummer or even a musician. I don't know. I just don't like calling myself a rhythmist. Now that works for me. I like that. And that was also titled a very good record by Stuart Copeland, but that's a whole other thing.
Right. Man, you're a pleasure to hang out with and talk to.
Enjoy it, Johnny Gowdy.
I hope that all of you enjoy this and you get something out of it.
If not, don't shoot me.
No, you won't shoot him. This is my guest, Donnie Wynn. It was great hanging with you, and we will have him back again.
Cool.
All right. When
it's bloody hell. We work until the dinner bell. We work until our bones are black and blue.
So that was my conversation with Donnie Wynn, my first two-part podcast. How did I get here? I'm your host, Johnny Gowdy. Thank you so much for listening again. I hope everyone's doing well out there. I have a couple of guests coming up. Next, we'll have Shane Lawler from the band Electric Touch and Sarah Hickman, who's the state musician and a very accomplished musician. Thanks for listening. Enjoy yourselves. Be careful out there.
When it's bloody hell, we keep opinions to ourselves or keep our feelings on the shelves, we do. We go kiss our later friends and drown ourselves in medicines and wake again to start the work we do. So chop, chop, raise a cup, another if one's not enough. Forget the childish stuff that we all do.